Okay, the clock on the wall says 1 o'clock. Somebody want to grab the door? Seal the room.
Ooh, we'll release gray smoke and black smoke.
Yes. So no one will know about our secrets. Our secrets will stay in this room.
That's right.
Excellent. Okay, hi everybody. As you all probably know, we've had role-playing games for about 40 years now, properly, going all the way back to Bronstein, back before Blackmore. We've had role-playing games for quite a long time, and yet, strangely, during a lot of that time, role-playing games have stayed... They've changed a lot, but a lot of them stayed very the same. There's been kind of like a core behavior that has been role-playing games for a very long time. But that is not necessarily the only way to do it. There are ways that, even to me, were very surprising. I didn't recognize that I was kind of presuming a lot of things about games, but I didn't kind of think outside my box. I even remember very distinctly times when I was being very close-minded about what was possible. And if I were to have attended this panel, and I say panel very liberally, excellent. If I were to have attended this panel years ago, I might have been like, I don't get it, I don't understand. So there will definitely be some things we talk about today where you kind of go like, I don't get what you mean when you say that. And you might think of it maybe in terms of some other games you've played, and I will do my best to try to bridge that gap. But if there's parts where it's just not clicking, we'll talk about it. Because sometimes I'll forget that there's things that people who have not necessarily played some of these games haven't seen, and it might be there for a little bit. There might be a disconnect in our communication. So with that warning in mind, also, people with heart conditions should not attend this panel. It may be exciting. You should definitely tell us if you have any medical conditions we should be aware of before we get started. This is GMless Role-Playing Games, and I am Ben Robbins. Hello. Thank you. And I'm still Ben Robbins, even if you don't applaud it. I really have no choice at this point. It's kind of works that way. I run Story Games Seattle, which is a weekly, almost double weekly now, open meetup group in the Seattle area, in Capitol Hill, and also we have another one in Greenwood, and we have another one in the east side, where you can come play games very much like the games we're going to talk about today. And I would definitely say as a preamble, me talking is going to be no substitute for sitting down at a table and trying this firsthand, playing. If you are in the area, come play. If you're in Portland, go play PDX and Ready Set Go Play. There's two groups in Portland. There's a group in Olympia. There's groups all over the place that play these kind of games. There's lots of opportunities, even if other people you know play games like this.
Also online.
Video. It can be a very different experience. Also, I wrote a game called Microscope. One of our examples for today.
Yay!
Woohoo! Woo!
Now, which is, in fact, a GMless game. It's kind of a weird example, though. Our other examples that we're going to bring about are going to be these. And before we get started, let me ask you a quick question. How many of you play role-playing games?
Woo!
Easy.
That's a large number. How many of you play role-playing games that are predominantly like GM'd role-playing games? Awesome. How many of you in those games are predominantly the GM? So, about 60-40, I would go, maybe 50-50, pretty close. I played GM'd role-playing games forever, decades on end, and I was the GM. I mean, that was my job. That's what I did. I was always the GM. And that, those of you who are hardcore GMs will relate, I think, when I say that. That is so much fun! Because even when you're not playing, you're building your world, you're refining all this stuff, you have this entire plethora of things you could do. And sometimes even the actual session at the table is not the best part, because sometimes that's when your awesome creations don't really click. Because stop and think about it for a second, right? There's a weird thing going on, right? You've spent... How much time do you guys spend preparing for a game when you're a GM? How much time? Shout it out.
It's like 2 hours per hour.
2 hours per hour, 2 to 1.
A week?
A week per session?
Full campaign.
Yeah, keep going.
5 per hour.
Yeah. Yeah. Does anybody feel bad about that? It's fun. It's a good time. But there's a weird thing that happens, right? You show up and you've got this stuff. You put all this work into it. You have this level of ownership. And then you show up to these people who are like, we're ready to play. But they don't know what's going on in your head. They don't know all the stuff you prepared. You are coming to the table with a very different set of expectations and kind of levels of involvement, right? They don't really know what you have planned. They don't know what's going to be awesome. They don't know what it is. They're not on the same page as you. There's no way to avoid that. They just aren't. It's not physically possible for them to be. It's been true about GMing since the dawn of time. That has advantages. Like, you then get to bring this kind of awesome stuff that you've carefully thought out. But it is inevitable that you have a level of ownership of what's going on and involvement that they don't have yet. Maybe in the first hour of play they don't. Maybe in the second hour of play they don't. Maybe by the third hour they do. Maybe 3 months into your campaign, they're up to speed. It's a weird thing. And if you stop and kind of compare it to any other facet of life, mm-hmm. it's weird. I mean, think of it this way, right? Like, in this situation here, I am kind of like the GM, right? I'm this person who's coming in, I got this stuff, and you guys are going to basically be pretty much receptive, and you're like, well, I wonder what he's got in mind, I don't know. And you'll get involved, and you'll ask questions and stuff like that, but we have this discrepancy of control. But in a normal social situation amongst people, do we really need to have somebody in charge of what we're doing? Anybody?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no.
Depends what you're doing, right? Depends how much you want to get done. Depends how much, like, you have a specific goal you're trying to accomplish, right? You might need somebody to be... like, if you're going out to dinner, you don't need somebody to, like, take the helm unless people get really hungry.
Well, so you totally do, and nobody would ever pick a place to go.
Genius, yeah, exactly. But... In a case like that, the genius is that you are, in fact, engaging in a very goal-oriented activity. You know what you want to get done. You want to get food done, right? Mm-hmm. You're not engaging in a creative, collaborative kind of thing, which is really what, at its heart, game should be, right? That should be the awesome part about gaming.
Dinner could be that, too.
Dinner can, yes.
Yeah.
Awesome.
The conversation.
So let's talk about the things. Like, so when you're a GM, the things that you're doing, we'll cover this kind of briefly, right? You're a referee, you're making judgment calls, you're sometimes a teacher of the rules, you're sometimes the person who makes the story that the people are going to play through, and sometimes, in fact, very often, you're a social arbiter. Mm-hmm. You keep people in line, right? You basically decide who gets to talk. Kind of weird. I mean, if you stop and think about it, like, you're amongst your peers, and yet... they have agreed that during this hour or so, you're going to be, well, an hour, 10 hours, 15 hours, whatever it is. You get to say, like, no, be quiet. I want to talk to the Hobbit thief for a second. You know, I mean, that's kind of a weird thing. And yet, why we like that, right? We're cool with that. I mean, there's a, and I've tried to think about why that is, why we're totally cool with that. And I think,
They're the one who put all the effort into it. It's their job to make sure it flows smoothly.
Yeah. And but likewise, yeah, go ahead.
Well, it's school.
Yeah.
You know, it's a classroom.
Yeah. But there's also, and I think there's a certain, a little off topic, but I think there's a certain, I think it's relaxing. If you're a player and you show up and you say, you know, Bob is in charge of making everything flow correctly and he's making sure that everyone's happy, I can be kind of a jackass. You know what I mean? I can be like, I have a deep, and he's like, hey, stop, I want to talk to the elf. And I'm like, ah, come on, okay, fine. And then I just sit back and have a Coke and I'm totally cool. I don't have to worry about kind of maintaining social order, which is, that's like a vacation. That's kind of awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of charming. Kind of addictive. Is somebody in the back did something? Yeah.
It's, you say, you know, the GM's in charge and the other person is along, or the other people are along for the ride. It's like one top and a whole bunch of bottoms.
Well, no, let me make one thing very, very clear, which is that, so I GM'd, again, like I said, for decades, and I love it, and it's great. So it will seem at times like I'm saying things that are going to be kind of like critical of GMing or critical of what people might call traditional gaming, but it's an awesome thing to do, it's fantastic, but you got to understand what the activities are. It's like saying, I like baseball, you know, I like swimming. They're both athletic activities, and you would never say to somebody, you love baseball, you therefore must love swimming. Or, because you love swimming, why are you hating on baseball so much? It's not like that. They're different activities. And sometimes when I talk about this stuff, people will go, wow, this is like divisive, you're kind of splitting up, we all should be doing the same thing. Like, no, we should understand what we're doing. We should understand the rules being different. So with that in mind, so with that little talking about GM games, Let's ask the inevitable question that I haven't asked yet, which is how many of you have played a game that has no GM? Ooh, better than ever. That's like not quite half. That's like 40%. That's pretty good. I think that's never going. How many of those of you who have played a game? How many of you have played Fiasco? Excellent. Fiasco. I bring up Fiasco first because Fiasco has made inroads into mainstream gaming. I don't know, just people who've never heard of GMless games have played Fiasco because it is a very accessible and awesome game that allows you to basically just jump right in and do awesome stuff.
It's also a tabletop game that appeared on the Tabletop Channel.
Yes, and actually, and yes, Will Wheaton. Yes, thank you, Will Wheaton. And yes, and 2 years before that, 2 years, he gave it a shout out at PAX, and that really gave it a lot of exposure. But at its core, that isn't what makes it work. What makes it work is that it's got a very genius design that basically is very accessible and lets you to relate to other people. So let's talk about. So some of you have played GMless games, some of you haven't. If you've never played a GMless game, you might look at it and say, are we just going to talk? Like, what are we doing? Like, are we just making stuff up? Are we, you know, without one person kind of having the mystery that is Rome and having the kind of the thing they have made in their head that they're revealing to you, it can seem kind of like, well, what the hell are we doing? The easiest way to think of the GMless game is that awesome creativity that the GM is engaging in beforehand is just happening now. It's happening at the table, and you're all doing it a little bit. It's not just a free-for-all. It's not all the games we have shown here all have different ways of restricting what you can do. Restricting, that's the key thing. It sounds weird, but if we all just made up stuff kind of whenever we wanted, yeah, it would be fun, whatever, but we wouldn't really... what would happen would be that just whoever wanted to talk the most would talk the most, and the people who were maybe awesome but quiet might not say anything. Yeah.
If you want an example of if there was no restrictions, watch 2 6-year-old boys play. No, I shot you. No, I have a deflector shield. No, but I shot you before you put it up.
Yeah.
It's like there's no resolution.
And even better, imagine that same situation, but imagine a third kid there who's very quiet, never says anything.
Right.
Is that kid playing the game? They kept participating. I mean, that's the... And so a lot of the games here, a lot of these GMless games, one of the core precepts, because there's no GM, what winds up happening is that everybody is an equal participant, and they have to be. You have to participate. And what you find, which is kind of shocking, if you've gamed with people for a long time, kind of alarming, is that people who previously... I'm going to stand up so I can see the people in the back. Hey, look. The people who previously you thought were... quiet, maybe not very creative, maybe they were just kind of here coasting along, suddenly you put them in a game where you get them to talk, you're getting their creative input, and they say stuff that blows you away, which is kind of amazing. People who were previously creative wallflowers will suddenly come out. And actually, to tell you the truth, that is why I play these games. I play these games because I know I can be creative, but when I'm with other people and I get them to do stuff, or the rules elicit responses from them, I have a way more amazing time seeing the cool things they make, and then I riff off the things they make, and it's fantastic. And frankly, it kind of gives you hope for humanity. When we play Story Game Seattle, we have random people come in. It's strangers every week. There's always new people coming in. We have at least 2 or 3 new people all the time. Some have never played role-playing games at all. Almost none of them have played story games or GMless games like the ones here. And yet they come in and they sit down, and in the space of an hour, they didn't even expect it. They just got off work. They don't think they're creative. I mean, what I say a lot of the thing is that if you think about it, we're not really called upon to be creative in our day-to-day life much at all. And if you stop and think about it in a normal adventure game, like you're playing D&D or something, how creative are you being called upon to be when you play? You're playing a character, but you're taking steps in that, but you're not really building. You're not being asked to suddenly, like, make something raw. Whereas in these games, because there is no GM, that is exactly what you're doing, which can be a little bit terrifying. So let's talk a little more concrete. So the games we have before us, we have 4 games here. They're all GMless games. They all approach the questions of how do you get this to work without somebody at the reins. They approach it very differently. So let's actually put them in order of craziness. It's the two in the middle could maybe swap. It's hard. It's about 50-50. So we've got, briefly, we've got Shock, Fiasco, Shock, Polaris, and Microscope, which I wrote. Let's talk a little bit about them to kind of give you a perspective of what is possible. So if we're playing a game together and we don't have a GM, right? We have to start, well, what the hell are we doing, step one? Like, what, we could be doing anything. We could make up any kind of a game, any kind of a story. Almost all of these games have some kind of a precept of what kind of story are we going to tell, or what kind of setting are we going to use. For example, Fiasco is incredibly accessible because it starts off with the idea of we're going to tell stories in the real world with kind of real people, but people with tragically poor impulse control. It's going to be a black comedy. There will be cocaine sold in a schoolyard to nuns. It's possibly the only game I've played in where somebody had sex with a crocodile, and the primary argument was like, is it really love, though? Or is it... I was like, yeah, and I will tell you with all honesty, I think it was. I had doubts. I thought he was just doing it for effect. I was like, no, I think there's some true love there. I think it's good. It ended badly, though.
That's a shocker.
It's an interspecies. Yeah, it's the people of the town were not ready. They were not ready for it. And it was also a crocodile in an alligator reserve, so he was like still a fish out of water. It was very awkward on both sides of the family. So accessible, normal, everyday stuff. That's the genius of Fiasco. Fiasco starts off with these very understandable settings, things that we can all kind of relate to, and just normal people, then taken a little bit kind of off to the dark side. It does these very, if you haven't played it, play it, absolutely. Because one of the things it does that will kind of blow your mind, you won't even realize how awesome it is. You'll go back later and say, oh, that game is so easy, we just role-played. I don't see the big deal. That's almost like a non-game. People will play Fiasco and then say, well, I didn't really see where the rules were. I don't get where the rules were. Because one of the genius things that it does is that, so you're playing D&D, you're going to play a D&D game, Pathfinder, whatever, you're going to show up the game, you're going to make a character, right? Gonna bring a character sheet. You're gonna make a character at home, probably. You're gonna bring it to the game, and we're all gonna separately do that, right? All four of us, five of us, whatever. We'll all have brought our characters to the game. We may not have any idea what each other's characters are before we start. The GM might not have any idea what our characters are before we start. Our characters are living in isolation, and as we play, we'll develop bonds. We'll rescue each other. We'll come together. But you know how it is, game one. You're like, you're what, a dwarf cleric? Okay, cool. You know, you're kind of not really sold on it. To skip that whole step of basically these characters not caring about each other, what Fiasco does, it starts off right off the bat. The way you make your... You don't start with a character. The way you make your character is by defining your relationships to the people around you. And you do that from a quasi-random table. And you do that where other people can assign you your relationships. So that's the beauty of it. You can be like, I got no idea what I'm going to do today. Like, awesome. Somebody rolls, somebody looks on the table, someone says, hey, you know what? I think you have a priest and confessor relationship with the person to your left. You're like, okay, well, oh, that is. And then like, oh, but wait, there's also the person to your right. It's a different relationship. What's your relationship there? Crime! You know, more specifically, art forgery. Okay, and then you lay these out. You got these left and right relationships, and then you brainstorm and say, well, okay, so priest confessor, crime. I must be the criminal confessing to the priest. But on the other side, that same person has another relationship that might be like, you know, mother, brother, sister, whatever. And they're like, no, actually, because of this, I really can't be the priest. My other thing is I'm a school teacher. I'm not the priest. Oh, I'm the priest. Okay, I'm the priest with the crime relationship. Okay. You know, and suddenly, and that's the laughter that you guys are experiencing right now, that is the beginning of Fiasco. People are like, oh, wait, so I'm, you know, the crossing guard who's also working for the FBI, you know. So the genius is, and this is, in a way, Fiasco has been incredibly educational to me personally, examining... Because I play with so many different people, and I watch what people do at a table. And the if you can have a game where people out of the gate know who they are and who they are specifically in relationship to the other characters, you have got it made. Your game will rock. Your game will be awesome. Because when I look at you, I know what to talk about. I'm like, oh yeah, I know who our people are. I know what I would say to you because I know we're in this crime business together. You don't have this vague like, oh, you're a dwarf cleric. Hello. You know, what do? I guess you cleric stuff.
I don't need healing right now, sorry.
Yeah, I don't need healing or stonework, so I'll be right. So that's the genius of Fiasco, and then there's a lot of things about Fiasco that are very rules light other than that, which make people kind of go, again, I didn't really notice the rules, but they got submarined. They didn't notice that the rules got them at the very beginning of the game. The game was set up like magic at the very beginning. And the weird part about that is you say, again, no GM, it's crazy, it's completely guideless, there's no story arc, there's no plan, but because we kind of get the tropes, this is an important thing. You've all watched movies, right? You've seen movies, you've read books, right? Even people who've never role-played have within them a really strong sense of story. Really strong, much more than you think. People really have it in their heads how stories work. You don't have to guide someone through a story. People will, if given the opportunity, generate story at the drop of a hat. You don't need someone to make the story ahead of time. So you play something like Fiasco, where the priest or forger next to the person who's the crossing guard from the FBI, you'll be like, I have no idea where this is going, and boom, 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 boom. The dominoes will just fall beautifully, and by the end you'll be like, that was awesome, that was fantastic. Yeah?
I'm just trying to picture in my head, how many people play this at once?
That's a very good question. And this is an important thing about a lot of these games. Because these games so much hinge upon creative contribution, and the importance of your personal creative contribution, smaller is better. People will say, yeah, I played Fiasco with like 7 people. And I'll go, that was a bad idea, because you each person there is 1/7. When we play our target, 4 is the magic number. 4 is a great number of people. 5 you can sometimes get away with. 3 can be awesome. Some games will work with 2, but 4 is the sweet spot, and there's a falling bell curve. And specifically, I should say, so that's Fiasco, which possibly can take the highest number. I'd say you can even do 5 with Fiasco, because it's a rollicking good time. Let's talk about some of these other games. For example, Shock, the game right next to it. Given that this is a sci-fi convention, Shock is your game. Planet of the Apes is my classic example. Planet of the Apes, the movie, the original, Charlton Heston, Damn Dirty Apes, right? What's that movie about? What's it about?
Little ponies, I don't know.
Come on, but then you wouldn't get the ending.
Racial discrimination.
Racial discrimination. It's about race, right? It's a race metaphor, right? Yeah. Most good classic sci-fi is not about spaceships. It's not about, you know, aliens. It's about looking at important issues of humanity, the human condition, through the lens of sci-fi. This is the game that does that. You actually start. So imagine you sit down to play. Again, you've got nothing prepared. And actually, I forget to say things that are important. These games are no preparation. You don't come to the table with anything except the game, right? You don't come with preconceptions about what you're going to play. You just come and sit down with 3 other people or 4 other people and say, let's start, which is crazy and magical. So with Shock, you start off by picking the issues you want to explore. You might say, like, each person will pick an issue secretly and then reveal them by surprise. And the reason we do that is because then when you reveal your issues, you will get bizarre combinations, like someone picked pollution. Unemployment, pollution, and what's that?
Non-sex trade.
That could totally get in there, yeah. Well, actually, it'd be more like, these are supposed to be issues about society, so it would be more like, you know, like sexism or sexual inequality or sex trade, something like that. But I think the example in that one was pollution, unemployment, I forget what the last one was. It's like always like genetic inferiority. And we're like, whoa, God, how do those go together? And what you do in the game is you take those issues and then you brainstorm what is called a shock, which is the thing that is different from the real world that impacts those issues or shines a light on those issues or reveals something. And in the space of a half an hour, you have suddenly generated a fantastic sci-fi world. You're like, holy crap. Like the one we did, again, with pollution, unemployment, I think genetic inferiority. Like, okay, yeah, so they've got, people want to go to the stars, but you only get to go if you're genetically superior. Nah, not really good. And they're like, well, what about, we get it. So, like, if you there's cryogenic storage, a cryosleeve, but the rich people basically get to, there's a, you know, pollution is causing environmental collapse, but the rich get to basically put in cryosleeve and wait it out. Like, oh yeah, that's good. And then we're like, no, twist a little farther, the unemployed get put in cryosleep. If you can't prove that you're worthy to society or keep a job, they put you on ice. And they have whole unemployment. You know, like, the unemployment agency actually just rates your worthiness. And this is 20 minutes in, and we're like, holy crap, that's awesome. And none of us thought of that individually.
Right.
That's
right.
The genius of it. You're brainstorming off of each other. Mm-hmm. I would never have thought of that idea. No one else at the table would have thought of it. No one came with that idea. But because we were building and bouncing off each other as equals, we suddenly had this fantastic idea that we had never come up with before. And then we get to make characters in that society and see them try to take down the government, try to, you know, get reunited with their brother, whatever story goal they have picked, they then get to pursue. And the end result with a game like that is generally that you walk away at the end thinking, we just wrote a book or a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And you see people walking away going like, I want to go write this. I want to go
yes.
Make this movie. I want to share the creation we have just made. And you do that every week.
Mm-hmm.
And you make a completely different, brand new, awesome thing.
Yeah.
How do you prevent ruts from occurring? It's like you play with four people all the time,
yep.
And eventually you come to a point where there's nothing new that you think of.
Yep. Relationship dries up. Get the 7-year itch. I start wandering. Start thinking. Yeah. Replace some personal ads. Yeah. Back at hobby shops. Curious. Maybe want to try some diceless gaming. Yeah. Yeah. We've all been there. Yeah. That strikes a bigger question, in fact, which is that not just how do you avoid getting bored with people playing the same thing. I could ask that about really any game. We've played D&D together for 10 years. Why aren't we bored with it? But when you want to do something different, you're a group, right?
Mm-hmm.
All of your group might not want to do something different. So, for example, like in my case, I was the GM. I was playing straight GM games. And I was like, hey, guys, I want to kind of mix it up. I want to try some new stuff. And I'm bringing out these crazy games. Like, come on, let's play some Shock. Let's play some Polaris. And it is kind of unfair to the other people in your group to just assume they will want to suddenly totally change everything they did. You guys like baseball, let's go swimming all the time now. you have to accept that the people you game with will not necessarily always want to do... So role-playing, but it's very different. Some people just want to play a straight GM game. That's perfectly reasonable. By the same token, other people who play GM-less games would gnaw their arm off if they were in a game where they were told... Nope, just be quiet and listen, I have the story control. They'd be like, but I have so many ideas. Nope, not your day. As far as the actual, specifically like in GM-less games, and that's another thing I should point out, is that a lot of these games, I think, not because they have to be, but because in the past, for decades, we had campaign games. We had D&D games. And you think of like a D&D game, you start up with your character, and you have a long-term goal in mind. Like, my character someday, you know, my first level fighter, may become a king, he might get a keep, he might rise to a lame level and clear land around his keep. And in the first edition joke, no one's getting that. you might clear it of monsters and gain silver pieces for every inhabitant nearby. And that's a long-term goal that might happen in first level. How long does it take you to get 10th level nowadays? What's the rate? They've made it faster. It
depends on the GM.
That's true, depends on the GM.
I have a GM that just throws levels at us if we feed him.
And that's a good relationship.
That's toast with jam.
Do not lose that GM. Yeah. No, and I mean, in the old days, it was very, 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 very slow. Game of 10th level took a long time,
yeah.
And they've made it faster and faster and faster. And I think one of the reasons there's a natural tendency to make it faster is that we as people, we want to see the story unfold. We want to see this character develop. We want to see change. And a lot of these games, because that was a niche that wasn't really satisfied, are one-shots where the entire arc of this character will unfold in 3 hours. They'll go from, you know, perfectly comfortable person in society to a revolutionary to having a big tragedy to overthrowing the government to looking at the monolith and having a transcendent experience and maybe going insane or not. We will see that all today. Like, bam! Which, as a gamer, seems crazy, but as a movie watcher, that's, God, of course, dude, yeah, you do that. You don't wait. And because of that, part of the precept of a lot of these games is that you cut only to the good parts. You only show the dramatic, awesome scenes. You don't have a lot of like, well, we're going to go to town, we're going to shop for stuff. I do like going to town shopping for stuff. I'm not mocking. I like kind of that. Yeah, go to town, linger. Yeah. Well, because these are games that are often about, very focused story, you get to the core points very quickly. You talk about the interesting encounters with the characters, the parts that really reveal their beliefs and what they feel and what they think, and really turn the story left and right. And for some people who aren't used to that, it can be like a roller coaster ride. Whiplash sets in. They're like, holy crap, wait, my wife just left me? It's scene one. I'm like, yeah, let's go. We're not having the scene where you guys just sit there and calmly talk. We know that happened. Let's move on. And they'll be like, slow it down. And I'm like, I'm not slowing it down.
Speed it up.
Yeah, which in fact takes us to this third game here, Polaris, which is a game of not slowing it down. And it's a game of... it's listed, and it is, a game of tragedy. This is another weird thing. So we're playing without a GM. It would be really helpful, therefore, if we agreed as a group what the hell we were doing. Like, what kind of game do we want to play? And some games, lovingly, like Polaris, tell you right on the front cover, it's a tragedy. We're going to play a tragedy. Your hero's going to lose.
Excellent.
Think about that, right? Normally when you're playing a game, you're playing a tactical game. You're trying to win, you're trying not to lose, you may lose, you may win, you might not, but you're trying to figure out which one it is. But once you know, like, I'm going down, and Fiasco shares this similarly. Fiasco is very much a, you're going to have a bad ending for your character. It is so liberating as a player. Mm-hmm. You're just deciding how you're going down. Like, what kind of mistake am I going to make that's going to damn me? And you're thinking less of the character as you, and more of the character as this character. You're like, looking at them going like, oh. You know, yeah, I do think my knight would lead the other knights to overthrow the king and wipe out thousands of years of tradition that I have sworn to. I think I would do that, because I think that's the best thing to do right now. You can free yourself to make these, like, extremely dramatic, tragic decisions and do heart-rending things that everyone at the table is just like, whoa, you just brainwashed your brother. Yeah, when a player did that, and I was like, that was so cold. You just totally brainwashed him to be part of your cult. It's like, yeah, he's my real brother now. And I was like, whoa! Oh my god! Yeah, like, okay, I need a break. That was so good. And that's that kind of thing that happened. Things come out of people's mouths, where you're just like, whoa! It is like super condensed, tight, awesome, goodness. And actually, as a corollary, I will point out that, like, when, I don't know about you guys, but when I used to play just things like Street D&D, we'd be like, yeah, we'll play all night. We'll play like a 12-hour game. That's cool. You know, chill. 12 hours would be like a nice, awesome game. We could do that for days straight. With one of these games, with a jamless game, where you're on, you're it. You're in the seat the whole time. You are required to put out creative content a lot. 3 hours in, you're like, you've run a marathon.
Yeah.
You're like, I need to go, I need a hug, and just lie down somewhere. Not because they're necessarily crazy emo all the time, but just you are making stuff happen. An hour goes by, and you're like, holy crap, was that only an hour? I feel like I've been here forever. But in a good way. You feel like you're really living at a very high tempo. So back to Polaris. Let's talk about Polaris for a second. Like I said, it's a tragedy. You know it's a tragedy. You're told it's a tragedy. Mechanically, it is impossible to survive. Your character is either going to die at the end or become that which they hate, the thing destroying their own society. You know that. It's a deal. Your character doesn't know. Your character's optimistic. Your character is cheerful. Your character. It's going to end well. And I'm going to fight for what I believe in, and I'm going to defend. It's going to be great. But we all know that's not going to happen. And like I said, knowing that is in fact a requirement of the game gives you suddenly a whole new eyeball looking at the character. You're not looking at them, like I said, you're not looking at them as though they're you anymore. You're like, this is a story. How do I want the story to be? And the person across from you, again, no GM, just all us, probably wants the story to be something different. and we have, at that point, what we call a conflict. Right? You say, I think it would be awesome at this point if you killed your brother in the parapets. You're like, no, I think I would, you know, I would talk my brother down and he would be shamed. We have a disagreement. And a lot of the times you'd say, well, I mean, it's I'm trying to think of a parallel in a classic GM game where that would be the case. But there's not really a parallel. It's a different cultural thing, the idea of a conflict, the conflict of disagreement, which you resolve. Different games resolve them differently. Some games would just be straight, I have a certain amount of dice currency, I have some authority with points or whatever that I can spend to make things happen the way I want. I'm using my power as a player, not as a character, as a player, to influence the story. Yeah, to influence the story the way I want. My author power, you might say. In Polaris, that's why I single out Polaris, it has a genius approach, which if you've not done it, you until you've done it, you're like, holy crap, it's amazing. So imagine you have what I can only call a series of overlapping ultimatums. So the example would be, you say, I leap to the parapets and I draw my sword and I cut down my brother, who's a traitor, by the way, we already knew that. And your antagonist, the other player whose job it is currently to make the life of your character hard. There's different roles in different games, and that's in the players, that's a role you would have. Their job right now, they're not a GM, they're very much not a GM, but they are. Their job is to make trouble for you in this moment in time. They would respond in this formal fashion. They're not going to roll dice, but they're going to respond in a formal way and say, effectively, yes, I will let you do that, but only if. And then they get to tack on something creative they want. But only if your sister sees this happen.
Ooh.
And I didn't have a sister like a minute ago. That person is I don't understand. Okay, fine. Okay, but I get to reply. Okay, but only if she knows what I did was for the best. And like, ooh, judo. Like, I've taken your move and I've flipped it over here. And the other people watch, and the important part is, it sounds like we're just talking, but actually we're engaged in a very formal, structured, rigid, it's like chess. I'm not allowed to just make three moves at once. I'm not allowed to kind of just higgly-piggly, it's a great word. I'm not allowed to just kind of do whatever I want. I have very formal ways I can respond and formal ways the other person will respond. So I but only if, they but only if. I have a couple options I can do. If I don't like it so much, I can pull back. I can retreat from my position and let them have the ground. I can stand my ground and be like, hell's no, which never works, just FYI. but the beauty is because when you engage in this this but only if snowball, you get stuff that happens that, like, you never, again, and you'll notice there's a recurring theme here. The recurring theme is stuff you never thought was going to happen that you then think is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Even stuff that will come out of your own mouth, you'll be but only ifing back, and suddenly you'll just be like, oh, but wait, so if I kill the brother, but only if the sister sees, but only if the sister thinks I'm, you know, still a good person, you know, and then you will come up with a reply to that that you just would never have anticipated, because again, none of those things existed a minute ago, right? You're responding, you're interacting, you're having this exchange. That is a there's no parallel to it in a pre-planned, you know, a pre-planned sitting down and writing something out ahead of time.
Say it.
But only if she's mad at you because she wanted to do it herself.
See? Now you're playing Polaris. Exactly. You know. But only if she's pregnant. But only if you're a child.
Right.
Which brings us to another important part. So only if the sister has my child. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Which brings up an important thing, which is that because there is no, we're talking about what the GM does, right? One of the things the GM does is set the tone of the game. Decide what's like okay, what we're going to include, what we don't. When a player starts doing wiggy stuff, that GM says, "Oh no, we're not having a slave ring in the game. No, we're not doing that." But in a GMless game, it's just us, just peeps. We have to work that stuff out amongst ourselves, almost like adults. It's crazy. How do we handle that? It's insane. I don't know. What are we going to do? I don't know. I'm at a loss. You know, it happens at dinner. You're having a discussion. Someone goes down a road, some topic they really want to talk about. Today they want to talk about gun control. And you're like, maybe you're cool with that. Maybe you're just not into that right now. Maybe someone is deeply bothered by that discussion. No way to know. You don't know. But because of that, in these games, we have simple techniques for signaling that. Not only signaling it, but bringing it to a close, being like, nope, I know that was your creative contribution, but that makes me uncomfortable. It's out. And we have a very cardinal rule that says we will all obey that. So this is not creative censorship.
Right.
That would be bad. This is not creative censorship. This is, I am personally uncomfortable by this, and I don't want it in there. And with that rule, with that capability to basically say, to draw the line, to basically to pull the handbrake, as it were, if you know you can do that at any time, and everybody will, like magic, agree to stop, sometimes you will find yourself comfortable getting into subject matter that you might not otherwise want to talk about. When someone says, let's have a game on a plantation in the South before the Civil War, some of us will be slaves and some of us will be slave owners. There's a game for that, just FYI. Sail Away Jordan? Sail Away Jordan? Yeah. Steal Away Jordan, right? You might say, hells no, am I going to play that game? But maybe with the knowledge that you have this escape valve,
mm-hmm.
you can call the end at any time or omit certain things, like, I don't want to watch that, I want to do that. And everyone else is like, done, out, we'll do it, great. People find that they will then engage in dangerous stuff, which gets to awesome things.
So you can say Ford out, basically, at any point.
Yeah.
Yeah,
is there, like, a red card and a yellow card?
The technique we use is, we call it drawing the veil, and there's a whole discussion of basically, drawing the veil is a shorthand for two different things, really. One is to say, I'm cool with that, but I want to fade to black on it. Like, torture scene, I get it, it's a torture scene. I don't need to go into detail, and it pulls his fingers out, the other is basically drawing a line where you say, I just don't want that in the game at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it's outie. Doesn't matter how long we've had it in the game, it's out. And the really fascinating part is, again, because with our weekly meetups, Story Game Seattle, everybody's strangers. We're not a regular group. Nobody knows anybody.
Yeah.
You never know what people's issues are. You can't know. It's not physically possible to even guess. Even something you think is a safe ground, like, yeah, and then a dog walks in. Nope, dogs freak me out. And it's not for me to say. I don't get to say that's not a fair thing to veil. That's not, you don't get to veil dogs. No, you do. I've been veiled a couple times, and it's not a bad thing. It's a very good thing. It's a very healthy thing. It means you really want people to do it. And we say at our basically welcome, oh my god, if you're uncomfortable, draw the veil. Oh my god. We beg of you, the worst game you will ever play will be the one where in your heart you're like, but you have no way to say it. And what's funny, I think, is that in a GM game, because the GM is there as this figure of authority, an actual person of authority, and we rely on them, this is kind of sad, actually, now I think about it. So for like the last 40 years, we've had GMs, and we've made them do a lot of this stuff, right? They control, they educate what is okay, we leave it to them, we make them decide what content is. It's prevented us, I think, in a way, as gamers, as an art, from developing the language of talking about what we want and don't want. Because we just say this one person's going to do it. So in a way, that's unfortunately kind of stunted our growth a little bit, and so it took 30 years to get to the point of having even the concept of like lines and veils. You know, and we got there, but, I mean, I think I remember being in a lot of games before that where I would have liked to know how to talk about that. You've all been in those games where the GM brings something in, a player brings something in, and we don't like it, but then nobody knows what to do, and people stomp off, or people talk about it later angrily. We don't have a language. Most groups don't have a language to say, I object to that, and it's not a hateful thing. I just don't want that in the game, right? And it's not a creative censorship thing. It's a, I am uncomfortable with that thing. It's a very powerful tool to have.
Yeah. Including an ordinary social, you know, discourse, you might like to be able to draw the veil.
Yeah, you might be able to. It's interesting because it's weird. I mean, it's the, at a game table, we're trying to do so much more, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can't just sit quietly and go, oh, they're talking about things. They're asking you to participate. They're sometimes asking you to pretend to be a person being exposed to this thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Your character's taken in the dungeon and tortured. You know, that's very... That's not a hypothetical talking about something you read in the news. That's having you think, well, what would you do if you were in that situation? You're down in the dungeon. You're chained to a wall. What would you do? It's very important, I think, in that situation to be able to be like, hey, you know what? No, I'm not going to walk through that process. Thank you, but no. So like I said, players also totally awesome because it teaches you the really important thing that but only if thing teaches you the method of antagonism and protagonism. It teaches you mind reading, actual freaking mind reading. Yeah, no, not even kidding. I'm dead serious. You can also bend spoons. You will have to hold the spoon in your hands and apply pressure with your hands. But I'm serious about the mind reading. I'm not even joking. It teaches you to look at another person and be like, they've been describing their character doing stuff. What do I think they really want for this character, right? Some of it's explicit, like some of it, there's parts where you're supposed to tell the other person what you want.
You mean you're learning consensus and empathy?
But it's like empathy, it's not even empathy for them, it's like empathy for a fictional thing in their head. It's crazy empathy. Yeah, yeah. No, it is, and it teaches you, all gaming teaches you awesome social skills, and we love it for that. And my sixth grade teacher is still pleased that we all became such nice kids from playing. It's not about the killing orcs, people. It's about getting along with the other players. No, it teaches you, when I say mind reading, I mean it teaches you to actually, like, see what they're, to kind of, like, watch really closely, the little things they say or do, and to kind of get on the same page with them and establish this kind of rapport that is, you know it when you're doing it, and you know it when you're not doing it. You know it when you're sitting across from somebody going, like, I'm not getting it. I'm not getting where they're going. We don't have a thing. I can look at a table from 10 feet away and go, aha, they're not making that bond. They're not getting that connection. And I will say that, frankly, because of that necessity, in order to basically collaboratively create things, you do have to have some kind of connection. A connection you do not have to have in a GM'd game. You can play a GM game. Okay, so here's a table, right? There's the GM, players sitting on both sides. You can have a person sitting next to you, like here, and you can game with them all night long, and it's totally cool, it's fine. But the person here, or here, to your sides, you are, in a way, you have a much harder time interacting with them socially compared to the person across from you who you can see, right? The best table for one of these games is a small four-person table where everyone's facing everybody at angles, but nobody is side-by-side. Side-by-side is a social killer. Right, you got to do this thing to look them in the eyes. You don't really know what their faces are doing. You can't really tell. You can play D&D all night long, have an awesome time, have a great time, without the need to really tightly bond with the other players around you. And in a way, that's awesome because it means you can have fun without this high level of social need. Like you can play chess all night without bonding with somebody. You don't even have to look at them. You can play chess. That's great. With these games, because the entire point is to engage with each other on a creative level. Oh yeah, you're in. You have to. You're going to interact with them. And you will find some people you will not want to then play with because of that. You're just not on the same page. Other people you would think, like, oh yeah, I wouldn't really want to play with them. And then you play with them and go, you know what? No, that was awesome. I was surprised. Their humanity shined through. And they are, in fact, much more awesome than I expected them to be. Which, like I said, is why these games, in many ways, ignite my love for humanity on a regular basis, which I didn't have before now.
Previously you're a misanthrope, now
totally, yeah, now I'm like, man, they're okay sometimes. Yeah, I think we should take these games to prison. We should basically make serial offenders play story games.
Play Fiasco. How could this go wrong?
I don't think the concept of fun would be understood in that.
Let me think about that for a second. I'm not sure that's true.
Yes. We're not playing for the escape, we're playing a game.
So, and we're getting close to the end, but I'll say real briefly then, so to follow our arc to the end. So when I wrote Microscope very much intending to do a number of things, one of which was to basically, have fun. To basically do all the stuff that I had always enjoyed as a GM, to let everybody at the table do it. Now, here, in the moment, at the table, making the awesome stuff together. And that's one whole side of it. There's another whole side of it, which is totally different, which is that when I played for decades, I would play with people, and I'd be looking at them, and I could tell, I'm like, they're here, they're playing, but they're waiting for me to be creative. They're loving my story. They're loving the game world. They want to know how it turns out. And at some point, I grew to hate that. I grew to really loathe the idea that they were the passive observers of my story. Really hated it. I loved making the game, but I felt like it was unfair. I felt like there's a power imbalance going on, like I was somehow stuck in the spotlight. And more importantly, that those people, while they didn't think that they were creative, I wanted to get their contribution. So one of the things that Microscope does is that, it, in fact, I say these other games kind of require you to participate. This game really requires you to participate. It, in fact, will make you contribute. It will make you make stuff based on what other people have done. It points to the game where we will just kind of stare at you and wait for you to make something. And it's very painful. It can be very awkward. But what's amazing is that then people who, like I said earlier, people who you've known for a long time will then say stuff that will just blow you away. You'll never have realized they were that creative. They never thought they were that creative. They're not even making something they think is cool. That's the best part. They throw something out that's like, well, okay, well, here's the thing, and they say it, and then you go, that's awesome. And then we all start, because of the way the game works, you just build on each other in sequence. You build on the stuff they made, and by the time it comes around again, this simple idea that they thought was not that great, we have all built into this magnificent thing. So it, when we stop and look back at it, we say, like, well, who made that? We each did. We each did a brick. And this person who didn't think they were creative, who didn't think that they had an awesome idea in their head, they were the root. They were the very foundation that made the first thing that launched us all on this fantastic idea. And they're kind of looking like, holy crap, I'm awesome. And also a different, like, I don't know if you guys want to come to the Women in Gaming Communities panel tonight. Another thing about it is that because it compartmentalizes when people contribute and how people contribute, it also avoids that problem of somebody like me who is got lots of ideas and can talk a lot. I could talk all day. It prevents people like me from hogging the game and lets other people speak out. It lets other people. It requires equal participation, which makes a lot of people who would otherwise be shy or would otherwise have a hard time speaking out, it gives them that space to do that, which then again leads to fantastic things. For example, 8-year-old girl, oh my god, 8-year-old girl played a game of Microscope, holy cow, genius, yeah. And also a 10-year-old boy at a different game, that was utterly fantastic. You see these things when you stop and let somebody contribute without your poking them, and say like, hey, it's on you, just give me what you got. No edits, no, you get these very surprising and fantastic results. And it makes me happy. And it makes me think, the future is safe. So it's like last questions, yeah.
Where can you pick up these games? I've purchased Fiasco before in a game store, yes. But I haven't seen
it. Indie Press Revolution is awesome. If you're in town, if you're in Seattle, Gamma Ray Games on Capitol Hill is the bomb! They are a great supporter of games of all stripes, and they're just a fantastic community place. Gamma Ray Games is fantastic. Indie Press Revolution is a great place online. A lot of the GMless games are small press, independent creators. A lot of them sell directly, a lot of them sell PDF, a variety of ways like that. So it's tricky. It's like the whole world is kind of hidden from you, and then suddenly you hit it with the pickaxe, and suddenly there's a whole cavern full of GMless games. Also, you can go to StoryGamesSeattle.com, which is where our meetup is, and you'll see there's whole threads of people talking about games we've played and analyzing them, saying, hey, what I liked about that, what I didn't. And they'll talk about games like this, and so we're always looking at the games. Yeah,
there's a local Story Game Convention July.
Go Play Northwest.
Yeah.
Go Play Northwest is the shizak. It's awesome. That would be this. That's right there. Go Play Northwest. It's great. Fabricator Rally is down in Olympia. Fantastic. There's in fact, you live in a wonderful time. So many options. So many options. And so many gazillions of awesome people. Oh, one last thing. The genius of a lot of these games is that, like, when we play at our Thursdays, we have trained facilitators who will basically teach you to play these games. You don't have to know nothing. You just have to show up with a good attitude, sit down, and we will play. So that's another great thing. So, any last questions? I think we're done for time. Awesome. Thanks, guys. Give yourself a round of applause.